Thanks for tuning in for the January 12th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. In the first segment, you'll hear an update on cryptogenic stroke that focuses on treatments and outcome. This week's feature interview will be on a recent systematic review on the worldwide incidence and prevalence of NMO. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find a Neurology podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, and all are available online. It's free for AN members.
Hi, this is Will Rondo. I'm a PA at Lahey Medical Center outside of Boston, and I am back with a What's Trending segment of the Neurology Podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Lee Schwamm, who among many titles is the Executive Vice Chair of Neurology at MGH in Boston. He is the lead author of a paper we'll be discussing titled Cryptogenic Stroke, Contemporary Trends, Treatments, and Outcomes in the U.S., published in Neurology Clinical Practice in October. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Will. I'm really happy to be here and talk about this important work with your listeners.
So tell us about the key takeaways from the paper, including a little bit about the Get With The Guidelines Stroke Registry.
Great. So I'm going to guess that most of your readers in the field of stroke or vascular neurology know a lot about Get With The Guidelines because we've published about 180 papers over the last decade or so. It's the world's largest stroke registry. It's a clinical registry based on inpatient care. And we have over 6 million patients in the registry now. It's been operating continuously since 2003. And we're enrolling about 500,000 or more strokes a year. So we've become almost de facto a surveillance level registry for stroke care in America.
Excellent. Now tell us about the key takeaways from this paper.
So this paper looked at a group of patients who were classified in the medical record as quote unquote cryptogenic etiology of their stroke at the time of discharge. And by that, we mean reminding folks about the TOAST classification criteria. There are suspected known causes of the etiology of the stroke. I believe this stroke was caused by large artery atherosclerosis or by small vessel occlusion or by cardioembolism. And the other category there that is of interest for ischemic stroke to talk about is other determined causes, which are rare causes like coagulopathies, hypercoagulability states, arterial dissection, things like that. Cryptogenic is really a placeholder for saying, I don't really know what caused that stroke. And it could be because number one, I didn't do enough of a workup. Number two, I did a full workup and I couldn't find a reason, or I did a full workup and I found more than one reason, competing etiologies. And so it's really important to understand cryptogenic itself is a bit of a heterogeneous diagnosis. We looked at documentation of the stroke subtype in this nationwide registry, and about 20% of the cases were found to be cryptogenic. That's about what we've seen in other registries and other trials that have tried to look at this question. We then asked the question, well, if we don't know what it is, can we figure out in reverse what it is by looking at the outcomes? In other words, does it behave more like patients with a clear-cut cardioembolic stroke or a large artery stroke or a small vessel occlusion? Interestingly, it's kind of in the middle. The discharge outcomes for patients with cryptogenic stroke tend to be better than those with cardioembolic or large vessel athero. Probably because, those strokes by and large are bigger and they cause more disability. And yet the outcomes were worse than those with small vessel strokes. That doesn't mean that cryptogenic is its own etiology and that it's intermediate between those. It means that it's probably a wastebasket that's filled with patients who have both small vessel occlusion, cardioembolic sources, as well as large artery atherosclerosis. And I think the final takeaway is we really need to do a better job with a standard stroke evaluation that thoroughly evaluates patients for the cause of their stroke. And we need to do that for more patients so that cryptogenic isn't a diagnosis you give someone after a CAT scan and a carotid ultrasound with no evaluation of serologic markers, no evaluation of intracranial vessel or extracranial vessel imaging. So we need to be more thorough and more evidence-based in our evaluations. And we need to do a better job explaining away some of those 20% of patients for whom treatment to prevent another stroke might be quite different.
Okay, that makes sense. How was your study different than previous studies looking at cryptogenic stroke?
Well, I think our study is different in a couple of important ways. Perhaps the biggest thing that we have going for us is just the power of this sample size because we have so many patients. We had 300,000 patients in this sample, of whom 63,000 reflected the 20% with cryptogenic stroke. And that just gives you the power to ask certain questions that you otherwise, you know, just couldn't ask. I think the second thing we have here is it's highly representative. It's from hospitals all across the United States, big, medium, and small. And lastly, it includes important information you can't find anywhere else, like the initial NIH stroke scale score. The diagnosis codes are validated. They're not just ICD-10 billing codes. They're clinical diagnoses that reflect the comorbidities. And I think that capacity to measure all of that, as well as the quality of care in these patients, and the fact that we can also capture reasons why care was not provided, make it an incredibly rich resource for producing papers like this.
Okay. So in their paper, you talked about a need for better documentation, which I think you pointed out a little bit in what you've just said. You spoke about the better need for documentation of stroke subtypes to improve stroke care. And obviously, telling neurologists to document more can be challenging these days. So how do we balance the need for improved documentation but spending less time looking at a computer?
I think what we're really talking about is doing evidence-based evaluation. So don't just take out your shotgun and order every test under the sun, but don't have lots of variability from one provider to the next. So really taking evidence and guidelines and translating it into practice is what we need to do. And quite frankly, that's where journals like Neurology Clinical Practice are so important and why we were so delighted to have the paper published in this journal. We need to just do a better job of being disciplined about the evaluations that we do, and we should make it easy for providers to document. So we could have notes that very clearly and very explicitly identify the investigations that were performed, the findings that were discovered, and how those lead to an etiologic diagnosis. I think, in fact, we could make documentation half as long. You look at a standard discharge summary from a hospitalization, it's like a Bible, and half of it is not particularly meaningful. Two paragraphs could summarize an entire admission and inform the treating physicians going forward as to what remains unevaluated and why the treatment recommendations were made.
Well, I'd have to wholeheartedly agree with your comments about the discharge and lots of the notes that we write. Okay, ready for a case?
Sure, let's talk about a case.
All right. So we've got a made-up 55-year-old female. She has a history of hypertension, no previous stroke. She presents with left-sided weakness, was found to have an embolic appearing infarct in the right precentral gyrus. Tell us about how you'd proceed with the workup on your stroke service.
So the first thing that would happen if this patient came in acutely, we would obviously run them through our acute stroke workflow. So let's just pretend for the moment that this person is outside the window for acute reperfusion therapy. They would come in, unless they had renal failure or an allergy to contrast dye, they would get a CT with a CT angiogram on arrival in the emergency room. That would exonerate the arteries from the arch of the aorta up to the vertex and would tell us if there was, for example, a significant degree of carotid stenosis in the right carotid artery. This precentral gyrus we know is in the anterior circulation. If there was a large anterior communicating artery and there was no or an occluded right carotid artery, it could potentially be from a left carotid artery stenosis. So we want to know the vascular anatomy. The next thing we'd say is 55 is right on the cusp of what we call young stroke. So we'd want to dig a little deeper in that history. Were there prior spontaneous abortions? Is there a family history of clotting disorders? We might want to do not just an arterial, but a venous hypercoagulability study, and that will depend in part on whether we suspect a PFO might be present. So an ultrasound in the hospital, definitely going to be needed. We'll do it with bubble, meaning agitated saline and a Valsalva maneuver. Done in the right hands by a well-experienced lab, that will pick up PFO in almost all cases, but sometimes a transesophageal echo is required. We tend to rely mostly on the transthoracic at my institution. We have a very good track record there. The EKG might have a finding called crochetage in the inferior leads, which is a notching in the upstroke of the QRS complex, and that also can be suspicious for a PFO. And then we would have a debate about whether or not we thought that that lesion was clearly embolic, or might it also be small vessel. Could be small vessel from chronic hypertension. Is there evidence of left ventricular hypertrophy to suggest that there's long-standing hypertension, or is this mild hypertension that really makes that less likely? And this person at our hospital would probably leave if those previous tests I mentioned didn't give me an answer or didn't commit me to lifelong anticoagulation. would end with an implanted cardiac monitor to evaluate for the possibility of post-stroke detection of atrial fibrillation. The cryptogenic stroke study, the Crystal AF study, found about 30% of patients had AF detected in the 36 months after insertion. But I think that we need to be very thoughtful about trying to identify patients with embolic appearing stroke who have the possibility of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, because untreated, the risk of another stroke is enormous, right? 16-fold reduction with anticoagulation. So that's a vital part of that workup.
Are all of these patients going to get a monitor implanted, or are you doing cardiac monitoring first for 30 days?
So for patients whose insurance will cover the costs of insertion and monitoring, we actually believe that it's more appropriate and effective. There's a nice cost-effectiveness study out of Europe. The NICE, N-I-C-E, Comparative Effectiveness Group, has demonstrated that it's a minority of patients in whom the AFib will be detected in those first 14 to 30 days, only about 5%. So most of the patients end up getting two monitorings, the patch and then the implant. And there's a significant portion of patients who either don't wear the patch, don't return the patch, or don't come back for the ICM once they've left the hospital. So we actually strongly favor going with the inserted device unless they can't return to us for care. For example, their insurance network doesn't include us, or there are other reasons why the device doesn't make sense to be inserted right away. And in those patients, we'll go with a patch. I will say that we just completed and are at the point of starting to analyze the Stroke AF study, which was a nationwide 400-plus patient study looking at implanted monitors and the detection of post-stroke AF in patients with known presumed etiology of large vessel athero or small vessel occlusion. And it makes the point that you don't have to be convinced that the prior index stroke was due to AFib to think about treating a patient differently with a prior stroke who now develops AFib. So if it's AFib-induced stroke or it's stroke-induced AFib, if you have AFib and the appropriate risk factors and your CHADS-VASc score is 2 or higher, you're probably appropriate for anticoagulation either way.
Okay. And you also mentioned the CT would be coupled with a CTA. Are all of your patients getting CTAs automatically?
Almost all of our patients, unless they've had a recent vascular evaluation or they have a contraindication to contrast material, would get that study. Quick, easy, done, and will often demonstrate aortic plaque or ostial disease of the origin of the vertebral arteries or other unsuspected pathology. May also just show you minor calcification in the wall of the carotid artery or the aorta, which lets you know that patient has atherosclerosis and therefore has an indication for statin therapy. So very cost-effective and efficacious screening test. If we go to MRI right away instead of CT for other reasons, like we're not sure it's a stroke, for example, then we might do an MRA at the same time, but we always do vessel imaging along with parenchymal imaging.
Okay. So let's assume during the first round of tests that we've done here that we haven't found a source. What would you prescribe for stroke prevention at discharge?
So I'm a evidence-based kind of guy. So if we don't find a clear-cut indication for anticoagulation, you're going to go out on either a single antiplatelet agent or a combination dual antiplatelet therapy based on the clinical trial data, depending on what category you fall into. If you have an arterial dissection with thromboembolism, especially if you have any residual thrombus visualized on imaging, then I'm probably going to put you on oral anticoagulation, even though the data for that is a little less certain. There's a selected subgroup of those patients, I think, who benefit from oral anticoagulation. But I think we've learned from Navigate ESIS and Respect ESIS that unselected anticoagulation of patients, even with a pattern that we think is embolic stroke of uncertain source, is not beneficial in reducing the risk of recurrent stroke, and it definitely increases the risk of bleeding.
Okay. So let's say that this patient followed up with you in a month, and again, we don't have a cause. Perhaps she went out on aspirin, or she went out on a combination of aspirin and Plavix. What further testing might you do as an outpatient if she comes to you?
Well, some of that might need to be completed from the workup at discharge. So maybe the tests for anticoagulation, for hypercoagulability, were sent at discharge, but they weren't available at the time of discharge. So I'll be reviewing all of the workup that was done as an inpatient, make sure there are no missing diagnostic stones that need to be turned over. Let's say we only sent arterial hypercoagulability when they were in the hospital, but the echo showed a PFO. well, now I'm going to get venous hypercoagulability studies, and I'm probably going to get an MRV of the pelvis, which will help our cardiac interventionalists decide what the best route will be for getting to that septum on the venous transit side, and whether to go in right groin versus left groin, and whether there's any intervention necessary in the pelvic veins if there was a May-Thurner syndrome that had significant venous stenosis, for example.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
I think what's really important for the listeners as we sort of sum up this segment is you're a detective and your job is to figure out as much as you can with circumstantial evidence about what you think the cause was, to see whether it pushes you over the edge from antiplatelet therapy to anticoagulation, whether it drives you from monotherapy to dual therapy, whether it requires that you do additional investigation into structural cardiac defects like PFOs or other forms of abnormal cardiac anatomy. So you really shouldn't sleep until you've exhausted the search or you feel like you've found your primary culprit.
I think that wraps it up. Today, I've been speaking with Lee Schwamm, who is the Executive Vice Chair of Neurology at MGH in Boston. He is the lead author of a paper titled Cryptogenic Stroke, Contemporary Trends, Treatments, and Outcomes in the U.S., published in Neurology Clinical Practice in October. Thanks so much, Lee, and take care.
Pleasure to be with you, Will. Thanks.
This is Stacey Clardy, and today we're talking with Zolt Elash of the University of Southern Denmark about his paper in the journal titled Worldwide Incidence and Prevalence of NMO, a Systematic Review. Thank you for joining us, Zolt.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So to arrive at an up-to-date, better estimate of how common neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, or NMO, really is, you and your group reviewed 33 papers. What is the worldwide average overall? Can you give us our best estimate in easily understood numbers? Are we looking at 1 in 1 million or more common?
Yes, so it's a little bit hard to estimate because the incidence and the prevalence data are different in different ethnic populations. So for example, the annual incidence, this is the new cases, in the white Caucasian population is about 0.5, 0.8 per million, which is quite close to what you just mentioned. But in Asian populations, it's roughly 5 times more common. And in populations with Black African ancestors, even 10 times higher. So if you would like somehow to calculate, then I would say that maybe it's about 1 in 1 million in white Caucasian population, but in Asians and in Black Africans, it's higher.
And are we talking just about aquaporin 4 positive cases, or does this also include seronegative and MOG antibody positive cases under the NMO umbrella in these studies?
Yes, you are absolutely right. So it was the problem when we reviewed all these studies, because actually all these studies included such patients. So also the aquaporin 4 antibody seronegative cases and also the MOG antibody positive cases. And in fact, there were only 5 studies which reported the serostatus specific prevalence date, and only 2 recent studies examined the anti-MOG antibodies in all the patients who did not have the aquaporin 4 antibodies. So that's a big problem, because if we would like to see the epidemiology more clearly, then we really need well-designed studies that, first of all, estimate the serostatus-specific prevalence for both the aquaporin 4 seropositive and seronegative cases. Then these studies should test all aquaporin 4 seronegative patients for anti-MOG, and then, of course, exclude those cases which are MOG antibody positive if we would like to estimate the NMOSD epidemiology. And then there is, of course, the MOG antibody positive prevalence. But for those, we have to design separate studies that cover the whole MOGAD or MOG antibody associated disease spectrum.
It's a great point. And hopefully, beginning in more modern times in the past year or so, when these sorts of studies are reviewed, people will insist on that. I imagine that you've reviewed some studies that were 5 and 10 years old when perhaps myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein IgG was not even commercially available to be tested. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And in fact, we reviewed studies for 20 years. So you can imagine that we also had papers or studies which did not even measure the aquaporin 4 antibodies. And of course, all the diagnostic criteria have been changed. So that complicates very much the epidemiological studies in NMOSD and in MOGAD.
Absolutely. But I'm glad that you've done this to give us at least some sort of sense of how common this is, or how rare, depending how you speak about it. Do you have any idea how many people in the world right now are actually living with NMOSD? What other diseases are similar to NMOSD, for example, in terms of incidence and prevalence that you could give us a comparison to?
Yes, this is a difficult question again, just because of the reasons I just mentioned. But we can calculate maybe in a way that if we consider the prevalence of NMOSD, which is in white Caucasian population, is around 10 in a million. And let's say it's 5 times higher in Asian and 10 times higher in African blacks. So then we may say that the average prevalence may be about 50 in a million. And this might be right if we consider that 2/3 of the world population have Asian and Black African ancestry, where, of course, NMOSD is more common and have the highest prevalence and incidence. So if we consider this and we consider that in 2018, the world population was about 7.5 billion people, then maybe they are around 300,000-400,000 people with NMOSD worldwide. And you asked also what kind of other diseases may have a similar frequency or prevalence incidence. And for example, Huntington disease and Wilson's disease are such diseases. So NMOSD is really a rare disease.
That's helpful for me. So Huntington's disease and Wilson's disease, similar. And you said, again, with the caveats, estimating maybe 300,000-400,000 people right now in the world with NMO.
Yeah, that's right.
And you alluded to this, but where in the world geographically is NMO the least common and where is it the most common right now based on the studies?
If we consider the large epidemiological studies, especially the recent one, then we can conclude that NMOSD is the least common in white Caucasians, of course, in areas where white Caucasians are the dominant population, while it is higher among Asians in Asia, and probably the most common in Black people with African ancestry.
This is interesting. In some sense, this, in my mind, contrasts with some of the older studies done in multiple sclerosis, suggesting that distance from the equator, which many speculate has to do more with vitamin D, was driving things. But you're saying really it is the genetic background more so than where you live and other things influencing, say, how far you are from the equator. Is that right?
It's not really clear. Some studies or reviews suggested that there is, for example, a difference according to the latitude. But the recent studies most probably do not fully support this. And the problem is that when we again compare studies which use the different methods for diagnosis and even for aquaporin 4 antibody measurement, we suggest that most probably the genetic mixture of the observed population is most likely also to contribute, because they are studies of different ethnic groups in different areas and comparison by a head-to-head design. And these are suggesting also that if we use the same strategy and the same method and compare different ethnic groups living in different areas, then the prevalence and the incidence is different depending on the ethnicity. And there are also other recent studies which actually examined different ethnic groups living in the same area where the environmental factors are comparable, and they found also the same. And we know from all these studies that Asian and African ancestries carry higher risk. Then we know that there is a familial clustering in about 3% of the cases. And there have been a few whole genome association studies which also indicated the genetic risk. And quite interestingly, we recently did also a head-to-head study where we compared two European populations, the Hungarian and the Danish, exactly with the same design and with overlapping research teams. And we found that the Hungarian population in the incidence and the prevalence were about twice of the Danish data. And they are also population-based studies in Austria, which is the neighboring country in Hungary. And Hungarian and Austrian people are living together in the same environment for 11 centuries. But the Austrian data are more similar to the Danish than to the Hungarian. So it also raises the issue whether is it possible that a mixture of some Asian genes in the Hungarian population may contribute to this difference. So that's why we concluded that actually maybe the genetic background might be also important in MOSD, similar to multiple sclerosis.
This is really interesting. And there's a lot in what you said there. I hear you saying that like any disease, it's going to be multifactorial, but it does seem that the genetic background is a large driver. And what you've done here is really lay the groundwork for all the follow-up studies that need to be done. You know, some of this work has started to look at if you're in the same region, does your genetic background still matter? But as you say, overall, some of these countries may have better or worse assays to test for the presence of NMO. And then the question that comes up in my mind is, are there other, you know, social determinants or something else that might unmask a genetic predisposition and you might manifest the disease? Do you know, is there any work being done in that space yet?
No, not yet. But I think this would be also very important. Also to examine the environmental factors like we did in multiple sclerosis or have done for a long time. In NMOSD, this is just the very beginning, I guess.
Absolutely. And because we also don't know yet of those who manifest the condition, what predicts their rate of disability or how they live with the disease. Is that correct? I haven't seen any work on that yet either.
Yes.
So it seems you've got a lot more work to do here if you like.
Absolutely. Yes.
What else needs to be done? I am so excited because this is maybe the groundwork that's going to allow us to ask all of those questions. You otherwise found that females are affected most commonly. What was the ratio there of female to male?
Yes, so this is according even to the latest studies, which are very well designed. The aquaporin 4 seropositive NMOSD is about 6-9 times more common in females.
Okay, and that's in keeping with sort of what we said, but it's good to hear that in mass, when we look at all the studies, including the more recent ones, that that ratio is holding up, that I've been telling my patients at least, and certainly is in keeping with most autoimmune conditions, not all, but most autoimmune conditions that more commonly affect women. And then again, age of onset, what did you calculate that to be?
Yes, so just to remark that this female preponderance is especially we can see in antibody-associated diseases. So maybe that's the difference, for example, compared to MS. And regarding the age, only a very few studies reported the age-specific incidence. But if we examine this, then the incidence and the prevalence are the highest in the 40, 60 years age group. So it's also higher than in multiple sclerosis. So it's a later onset in NMOSD.
All very interesting and important data to continue to carry into the future. Any last thoughts that you have that you want to share with us based on this work?
Yeah, so our review was a critical review, actually. That's why at the end, we also discussed how can we improve and how can we design better studies in the future. And we summarized, and we really would like to stress that a large population should be examined because this is a rare disease. So most probably to examine the incidence and the prevalence of NMOSD and the rare diseases, populations with 200,000 size is probably not enough. And the other important thing is that the populations should be followed for a long time because these are rare diseases and there is a natural variation of incidence annually. So you have to compensate for this if this is a rare disease. And that's why you need really a population with a long time follow-up. And of course, it's important what kind of assay we use, and it should be the recommended antibody assay. This is the cell-based assay. It's very important, the strict adherence to the criteria and exclusion of alternative diagnosis. And if we do such studies, which is a spectrum, then of course you need to use multiple sources. We discussed a little bit about the exclusion of the MOG antibody positive cases, which is very important. It's important to include also pediatric sources. And the best would be a prospective epidemiological study, but it's very difficult to do and probably expensive. And the last, what we also discussed a little bit and what I mentioned, that head-to-head designs with overlapping teams to compare different regions and different ethnicities is also very important.
Absolutely. And including everything you said in there too, socioeconomic factors, country, everything, you know, all the things that can inform, do you even get diagnosed? And then if you do get diagnosed, how do you do afterward? This is a fantastic paper. Again, it's Worldwide Incidence and Prevalence of NMO, a systematic review, laying the groundwork for the future going forward in investigating the epidemiology of neuromyelitis optica. Thank you again for taking the time to talk about this rare disorder and bring us toward a better understanding of how rare it is and how we need to study it better in the future as well.
Thank you very much, Stacy.
Please take a look at this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.